This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our next conversation today is a matter of life and death. We're going to be talking about accidents. And every time I use that word, I want you to remember that it's in scare quotes, so-called accidents, because my next guest argues that the very idea of accidents is a deliberate disordering of our thinking, cultivated over decades, that keeps us from doing things that might prevent a lot of unnecessary injury and death. Jesse Singer is a journalist whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and The Guardian, among other outlets. Her book, published last year, is called There Are No Accidents: The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. In the introduction, Singer writes, Americans die by accident more than by stroke, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, pneumonia, kidney failure, suicide, septicemia, liver disease, hypertension, Parkinson's disease, or terrorism. Yet despite the death toll, there is no fun run for accidental death research or public memorial for the accidental dead. Singer goes on, what we call accidents, the traffic crashes, the house fires, the falls and drownings, rarely register as a point of public concern. Why are accidents so common? Why are accidents killing us more than ever? Why don't we talk about it? And what can we do to stem the rising tide of death and life-altering injury? This book seeks answers to those questions. Jesse Singer joins us now. Jesse, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you have questions or comments about what you hear us talking about, the number is 800-222-9455. So, Jesse, I want to begin by asking you for a simple definition. What is an accident?
It's a great question, but unfortunately, the answer isn't simple. And this is actually at the core of a lot of what we get wrong about accidents. So I'm going to talk about two different definitions, the general cultural one and the medical one. And the general culture one is a bit tricky because there's actually two definitions of accident as we talk about them in public. And those definitions actually contradict with each other. So an accident is defined as a random event, but it is also defined as a harmful event, which means at once, by definition, it is unpredictable, but with a predictable outcome. And further complicating things is that studies show that when we hear the word accident, we actually don't think about either of those definitions. We think about the word unintentional. And this is at the core of what we get wrong, because we focus on intention, which is to say the last person involved, who did what wrong. And from that perspective, accidents seem random and behavioral. And that's why we ignore the sort of layered causality that leads to harm and the way that dangerous conditions stack up to expose us to risk. Now, that's the general definition. But officially, medically, however, when I talk about accidental death, what I'm talking about is unintentional injury death. So every way we die in the United States outside of disease or violence. And this is a huge, huge group of harm. It includes overdoses, falls, traffic crashes, fires, drownings, freezings, starvings, overheatings, a long, long list and a growing one. The risk of these unintentional injury deaths has been rising for some time now. More than 224,000 people are killed every year. 62 million are injured in a year by these group of causes. And after decades of decline, the rate of these unintentional injury deaths has been rising since 1992 and has grown more than 130% in that time.
I want to dive more into this idea of how we think about accidents, the psychology of it. Maybe we can begin by talking about Joseph Weitz. Who was Joseph Weitz?
Joseph Weitz was a truck driver working in New York City at a moment when automobiles were rising in popularity and city streets were shifting in New York City, where I live, and in a lot of cities around the country. Automobiles were becoming more affordable, more accessible, and the nature of streets was changing. You know, streets were these places where for a long time in cities, they were open air marketplaces. They were places where kids had played. But now that automobiles were everywhere, they were suddenly these places of conflict. And what happened in with Joseph Weiss is he was driving his truck through Manhattan, and he struck and killed a child named Erwin Oster. And that little boy died. And what happened in response was that a mob formed. A mob of people came and dragged Joseph Weiss out of his truck and nearly killed him. Before a police officer intervened, literally putting his body between the truck driver and the crowd and pointing his gun at the crowd, only to be able to arrest this truck driver. And it's an interesting thing to look at because that doesn't happen anymore. We no longer see mobs incited after someone is killed in a traffic crash. Rather, we just sort of nod at it and say, oh, it was an accident. And it's an interesting testament to how what, you know, different types of harm become accessible and acceptable to us and unacceptable to us based on what we're exposed to. And accidents, these things we call accidents, happen so often. While they didn't at that time, it was less common that, you know, we respond to them almost dully, as though they are unpreventable, commonplace, part of the daily routine.
Yeah, there's another anecdote you have from that time period, which is the sort of the rise of the word jaywalker. I was interested to learn that the jay, if we were doing this show 100, maybe 110 years ago, we probably would have to bleep the word jay, maybe, depending on, you know, assuming radio had existed back then, because it was such a terrible insult. Can you talk about the origin of the word jaywalker and its cousin?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the word jaywalker meant a jay was a hillbilly. And so to be a jaywalker meant to walk like a country bumpkin. And this is interesting because, like I was saying, there was a time when city streets were just full of people walking and they weren't full of cars. And so the idea of jaywalking, which today is a law in every state, it's illegal to jaywalk. But the idea that that was a bad thing, that to walk in the street was a bad thing, had to be invented. And so essentially, automakers invented this term of the jaywalker as a way to demonize the idea of a pedestrian being in the street, to turn it from something normal into something, you know, looked down upon. And they actually like put effort into popularizing this term as a way to change the dynamic of what was an accident, of who was responsible for harm, and, you know, who was to blame when things went wrong. Because if you were a jaywalker and you got hit by a car, instead of just, you know, what you would have been a decade prior, a normal person using the street, suddenly you were this dumb hillbilly who didn't know how to walk on a city street.
Yeah, interesting that the term jay was apparently so, I think you cite the New York Times calling it truly shocking when a New York City police commissioner used it in 1915. But there used to be a jay driver as sort of like a counter insult. That didn't stick.
It didn't stick. And, you know, part of the reason why is I don't think there was a commercial value to it. You know, those two terms rose at a time when what streets were for in cities was a fight, an active fight. We were fighting over who had control of the street. And when it comes down to it, the automobile lobby had a lot of money to put behind pushing the idea that people shouldn't be in the street, and of telling the stories that the reason that people were killed in traffic crashes was because someone was walking like a hillbilly. And they did that by, you know, funding for earliest crash reporting and telling these stories that the person who did something wrong here was the person walking in the street.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with author Jesse Singer, whose book is There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. If you want to join our conversation today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So we've been talking about the sort of framing of who gets to use the street, who is the proper user of a street, right? Is it the, you know, the old timey kid with a hoop and a stick, or the you know, the Model T driver back in the day? I think that fight is largely done in many places, but this raises the question of blame And a few years ago, I got into this concept of moral luck, right? The idea, hypothetically, let's say you're driving tired after a long work shift, you hit a tree, maybe you get a ticket. If you have the same intentions and circumstances, and you instead hit a person, you may well be going to prison. Can you talk about why the law depends on luck in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting at a really interesting point, which is that, you know, two people take the same actions, they have different outcomes, and where we see, you know, one person punished as a murderer and another person not punished at all, we see the law kind of solving for our psychological discomfort with things going wrong, and especially things going wrong in a way that seems random and terrifying. You know, but if we're going to say two people take the same actions, one person is punished and one is not, we both fail to address the problem, and we show our hand as somewhat hypocritical about the purpose of punishment. And I actually think this gets even more interesting if we look into research about intention and what that reveals about moral luck and punishment. One study I like to cite is a researcher looked at how we feel about two teen drivers. Two teen drivers are both speeding. One is speeding home to hide a gift for his parents. The other is speeding home to hide cocaine from his parents. Both teen drivers hit someone and kill someone. So they both have bad luck in this circumstance. But in the study, respondents found the latter driver, the cocaine hider, to be more to blame in the death because they didn't like his motivations, even though the actions were the same. And you see another version of this when you look at speeding and drunk driving and how we enforce these in general. Now, there's a similar number of people killed speeding and drunk driving in this country every year. But drunkenness is enforced at the legal limit, down to the 0.1%. You're 0.1% over the limit, you're in trouble. But speeding is only enforced if you're driving up to 10 miles per hour over the limit, even though a few miles per hour makes a huge difference in outcomes of whether someone lives and dies when they're struck by a car. But because one of the actions is stigmatized, drunk driving, and the other is accepted, everyone speeds, then we have different conceptions of how those things should be enforced. And I understand this. I understand wanting to find a bad guy when something goes wrong. But if two people can make the same mistakes and they'll have different results, then we can control the results. It's like a point that to make mistakes is human, that mistakes and bad decisions are inevitable, but our failure to protect people from consequences is not.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about when there are reports of accidents, people sort of have this sort of go-to idea in their mind. They say, oh, was the person in the road? Were they wearing a helmet? Can you talk more about why our mind jumps to that place? Why our brains are wired this way?
Yeah, and I want to give us all a little grace here. You know, the reason we have accidents is that the underlying psychology here is comforting. We are drawn to it. In the face of random horror, blame is comforting. And there's an idea here that psychologists call the fundamental attribution error that explains how we blame. And essentially, it is the belief that our own mistakes were caused by the circumstances we faced, but other people's mistakes are caused by their personal failings. And psychologists call this fundamental because we attribute blame this way, even in the face of all evidence to the contrary. We think that bad things happen to other people because they're bad people. And when bad things happen to us, it's because of the conditions we faced. And this is, interestingly, something I talk about in my book is that empathy is sort of the magic sauce of solving the accident problem. Because if we can empathize with people who make mistakes, with people who make bad decisions, with people who do things wrong. If we presume they have the best intentions, even the drunk driver, for example, if we do that, then we can correct the inherent dangers that cause harm. We can, you know, change road designs so drunk driving is less likely to have a disastrous outcome. We can look at how someone who's going to drink might have no other option to get to the bar on any given night, and ask why we build parking lots and bars if we're so concerned about drunk driving. And these all kind of add up
about that is such a good, yeah,
because the truth is we mistakes and bad decisions are inevitable, but a failure to protect people from consequences is not. And the only way historically we've ever been able to effectively systemically save lives is not by punishing people, but, you know, for making mistakes or bad decisions, but by protecting them, throwing a pillow between them and their mistakes, you know, even when they screw up.
Seatbelt laws, for example. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, like on roads for decades, we considered traffic accidents to be caused by bad drivers and bad pedestrians. So adding to the nomenclature of jaywalker is the nut behind the wheel, which again was language that, you know, automakers really pushed forward and pushed into, you know, into the conversation. And that was the answer for decades. The reason people die is because they drive like nuts or they're hillbilly walkers. But nothing changed, at least for people inside cars, until we changed cars. We installed airbags, we installed seatbelts, we changed how glass shattered, and that made all the difference. And I think this is a really, the core construct to understand here is that seatbelts and airbags do not make you a good driver. They don't prevent you from making mistakes or bad decisions. They don't prevent human error. People still drive terribly. What seatbelts and airbags do is they prevent harm. They prevent death and injury when we inevitably screw up.
That safety margin of, you know, giving you a little room for error. All right, we need to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Jesse Singer. Her book is There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. When we come back, we're going to talk about how some of these ideas are applicable to some of the recent incidents in the news we've heard about that could be characterized as accidents, such as the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and the resulting chemical spill, as well as last week's massive crash on Interstate 55 here in Illinois owing to a dust storm. That's coming up after a short break. If you want to join our conversation, again, the number to call is 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the journalist Jesse Singer, who has written for The Washington Post, Bloomberg, The Atlantic, among other outlets. Her book, which came out last year, is called There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. If you want to join us, send an email anytime to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Jesse, but before the break, we spent a lot of time talking about sort of the psychology of accidents and human understanding. And the book is deeply reported. There's a lot of research. It's also a very personal book, though, because you write about a friend of yours named Eric Ng. To the extent you're comfortable talking about it, can you just tell us who was Eric?
Yeah. So the book is dedicated to Eric Ng. Eric was a New York City high school math teacher. He was a musician. He was a really funny guy. He was my best friend. And he was 22 years old when he was killed. And I can tell that story, which is kind of at the core of the book, and definitely why I wrote it.
Yeah, please do.
So yeah, in 2006, Eric was riding his bike on a separated biking and walking path that runs along the west side of Manhattan. And he was killed there. He was killed by a driver who mistakenly turned and entered the path and then drove downtown. And that driver was drunk and speeding, and he went to prison. But the impetus for the book happened 11 years later. You know, for 11 years, that was the end of the story for me. But 11 years after Eric was killed, a different man rented a truck, and he followed the same route as my best friend's killer, except he intentionally turned onto this biking and walking path. He killed 8 people and injured 11 in an act of vehicular terrorism. And I remember that morning, it was Halloween, and I heard about what had happened, and I was so genuinely shocked that the exact same thing had happened. That if you just looked at the path to harm, at the actions, you know, devoid of moral luck, you saw 2 people who did the exact same thing. And
I started to look into what had happened to Eric a little closer at the place where he had died. And I found that other people had been killed right where he was killed, before he was killed and after he was killed, on the same path. Now, every time, the drivers were different. Some were distracted, some were lost, some were drunk. But every time, the story that was told was it was an accident. And so no problems were solved, except for occasionally sending someone to jail. But after the terror attack, problems were solved. After the intentional act, the city and state got together and they made the harm impossible. They barricaded every entrance to this biking and walking path so you could walk through and you could bike through, but a car couldn't fit through. And for me, that change was this revelation that accident was a magic word of willful ignorance. It was a way that we chose to ignore preventable harm.
Yeah, and this is interesting, and this is a bit maybe far afield, but I think about this in the context of these mass shootings we keep having, right? One imagines that if it was not perpetrated by, if this was like an act of terrorism, right? Clearly an act of terrorism, maybe by some foreign actors as we had after 9/11, you could imagine the government's response being different and just the collective response of Americans. But when we dismiss things as accidents, it's, well, like, what are you going to do? Whereas terrorism, well, we'll put up planters or barricades or something like that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think people don't like to hear this, but the answer to the mass intentional shooting is the same as the answer to the accidental shooting. You know, the answer to the traffic crash is the same as the answer to the vehicular terrorist attack. The answer to arson is the same as the answer to accidental fire, which is giving up this idea that intention and behavior are going to somehow be something we can respond to and solve a problem, and instead building systemic safety into the environment. You know, because that bollard that would have protected Eric also will stop a terrorist attack. The gun regulation that makes it harder to access weapons is going to stop the accidental shooting as well as the mass shooting. The simple measures like sprinkler systems in a building is going to prevent people from dying in a fire, whether it's an arson or an accident.
How do you respond to people who say that, okay, what happened to Eric, terrible tragedy, but are you sure it wasn't really an accident? You still get that question a lot in the book.
Yeah, I do. I do. And I like to, you know, turn to the data here, because I think at the core of our ignorance about accidents is the idea that accidents are random. And we've talked about why we want to think this and the comfort of victim blaming. But it's also really important to note that accidents are not random. Like, it is statistically not true. Like, if you were to say accidents are random, then injury-related death would fall randomly across the country, but it does not. People living in poverty and people of color are most likely to die by accident. And this is especially true for accidents where policy and infrastructure make a difference between life and death. So the safety of our homes, our roads, and our workplaces. To name a few examples, Black people are killed in fires at twice the rate of white people. Indigenous people are struck by cars at more than twice the rate of white people. People in West Virginia, a relatively poor state, are more than twice as likely to die by accident as people just across the state line in Virginia, which is, of course, a wealthy state. And so what does this tell us? This tells us that, of course, these are not accidents. Of course, this is not a matter of individual behavior, but a matter of policy decisions leading to risk unequally distributed across the U.S. So where we want to think of these as a matter of personal responsibility or unintentional mistakes, it's just actually a matter of risk exposure. And there's further evidence of this if we look outside the U.S., because among our peer nations, you are much, much more likely to die by accident in the U.S. than in any other wealthy country. And this is because we treat risk differently in this country than we do in other countries. So when people tell me, they're like, isn't it just an accident? I would say, I don't know. Are you less responsible than someone in Sweden? You know, are people in Texas worse drivers than people in New York City? I don't think anyone would make those arguments. It's just comfortable in looking at the individual accident to say, this must be the fault of the person who's dead, because that makes me feel better.
And people see themselves in the role of the perpetrator, potentially.
Absolutely. And that's why we want to focus on accidents being about individual behavior, because First of all, the last person at the end of the causal chain is often dead and they can't speak up for themselves. But it also makes them the most comforting person to blame, because however grotesque this is, it means the problem is cognitively solved. It means, you know, you can differentiate your behavior from the person who's dead. And then you get to stop worrying and being upset about this so-called accident, because you can say, well, I wouldn't have done what they did. It's like the simplest, easiest, most emotionally safe way to think about an accident, that it's a matter of an individual's behavior. But if you look at who dies by accidents in this country, the fact that it is low-income people and people of color who are most likely to die, especially in accidents that are born of our policy and infrastructure, then it is an especially grotesque idea.
There's an example of this infrastructure that struck me a few years ago. I was talking to a Democratic operative in Springfield who was lamenting the fact that near a brand new YMCA on the wealthier west side of town, the city had installed this traffic circle, right? This seemingly innovative idea for managing the flow of traffic. Yet on the east side of town, which is lower income, predominantly black, the sidewalks are in such disrepair that people who use wheelchairs or rascal type scooter things to get around will often just go on the street because it's better than having to deal with the sidewalks. And it just seems like an example of the sort of investment choices and infrastructure decisions that are, you know, collectively, this is what we call systemic racism, right? Nobody's really making the description, ha, I'll show those people on the east side. But we make these choices, and the outcomes, the disparate outcomes you talked about, are the consequences.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's, you know, a little hard for people to wrap their heads around in this is that it's not just that one decision. It's the way that policy decisions sort of layer up risk, and that those layers are stacked a bit thicker for some people than others. So like looking at traffic crashes, which are across the country more likely in low-income non-white neighborhoods, it's the lack of sidewalks. But it's also that the road repair budgets are less in these neighborhoods. It's also that car ownership is less likely if you have less money, so you're more likely to be walking or biking or on a scooter, exposed outside the shell of a car. It's also that transit is less likely to be built when it serves a non-white community. And so you're more likely to be in a car situation where individual risk exposures are more common. But it's also historic and built into infrastructure, because you can look at something like redlining policies, which undermined Black homeownership, you know, 70 years ago. And those homeownership, those home loan policies that prevented Black people from owning homes also led to so-called slum clearance. And these so-called slums were cleared so that, you know, in the 40s and 50s, the US government could build highways and build them through decimated Black communities. So what that means today is that Black people aren't only less likely to own a home, they're also more likely to have highway speed traffic running through their neighborhood. And so each one of those is a tick on the risk box, a tick of exposure that makes each individual accident more likely. But then we see that's just that one accident. We think, oh, someone drove bad. I wouldn't drive like them. Someone crossed the street when they shouldn't. I wouldn't do that.
Let's go to the phones now. Randy is calling from Peoria County on line 4. Randy, thanks for holding and thanks for calling in.
Yeah, what this lady is saying is so true. I drove a school bus for a number of years for our school district because they couldn't get enough drivers. And I took afternoon athletic events and things like that because I had a commercial license. And in an unfamiliar community, I came very near to striking someone so close it haunts me to this day. And it was 20 years ago. Nothing came of it, but I have thought often how my life would have changed, and of course the individuals as well, had that have happened. And when I think back on it, I think of it so often, it was due to no clear crosswalks marked there, no way for the individual to know where he should have walked, and people would have probably come to my defense, and I would have been as much at fault as him, which haunts me, it horrifies me. But the fact of the matter is, neither one of us, we both would have been at fault, and both of us would have been innocent, too. It was horrifying to me. There was no sure. clear way for either one of us to know what to do. I just, what this lady's saying is correct. There was, the community had made no, and a lot of students were crossing there every day. I see, it still horrifies me. What this lady's yeah. saying is exactly correct.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for calling in to share that, and I'm glad fortune was on your side and that of the young person that day. Jesse, only about a minute left in our time together. I don't know if you want to respond to what Randy had to say or final thoughts on this topic.
I can do both, and thank you for sharing that, Randy. I mean, I think it gets at a key point, which is that there are so many solutions to problems if we stop focusing on behavior. Who was wrong or right in that situation, and instead look at our built environment, look at the ways we expose people to risk. You know, wider roads mean people drive faster. On narrower roads, they drive slower. When we give less road space to cars and more space to transit, then trips should shift out of cars and everyone is a little bit safer. And those are just a million tiny ways that we can reduce risk exposure. And the truth is that, you know, mistakes and bad decisions, they're inevitable, but we can protect people from these consequences. And just as a last thought, I don't say the word accident in my day-to-day, and I would encourage you not to say it too. But more importantly, I would love if everyone listening today could hear the word accident like an alarm bell. When you hear someone call something an accident, start to ask questions. Say, has this happened before? Could it happen again? How can we protect people from harm, even if they make mistakes? Even if they make bad decisions, so that this doesn't happen again.
That's a great parting thought. Let the word accident be a call for skepticism and action. Jesse Singer, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse Singer's book is There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. That's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can find our past segments on our website. Maybe if you enjoyed this conversation today, you wanted to share it with someone, you can do that through our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast or just find us on Apple or Spotify. Search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.